Welcome to Mustard A&A's. I am Matt.
I am Richard.
We discuss things in the entertainment industry that capture our interest, however briefly. Movies, DVDs, TV, video games, whatever.
Yep.
Pretty loose. And we're trying something in that you're about to start watching the Seahawks game. I am facing away from the screen. And if you reveal anything about the progress of the game, I will hurl my microphone at your head.
Okay.
So that'll be exciting.
Something to look forward to.
Brings a little edge to the podcast.
Exactly. Something to look forward to.
So we're doing this on the last day of 2006.
Is today? Oh, my God, it is. I am, you know, my buddy called me, or, you know, Mark called me on Friday afternoon or Friday evening going, dude, you want to go do something? Do you see me? I go, sure. What? I don't know. In my brain, I thought it was like Tuesday. I've been working so hard this week. I didn't even know I was completely flummoxed when he said it was Friday. So the fact that today's New Year's Eve, I don't know. I just, wow.
So really, we should have done our 2006 wrap up today.
Yeah, whatever. But that's,
you know, in thinking about it, as we went through our list last week, talking about, you know, what would be your favorite movie, I really would put, of those I've seen, Casino Royale as probably my favorite movie last year. Not necessarily that it was the best, but it was the one I enjoyed the most, the one I paid twice to see.
Yeah. One on the list I forgot was a little movie that didn't make any money, but I loved it when I saw it, was this Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story, mm-hmm. which was a really good movie, didn't apparently even make it in the top 100, but I totally forgot, and that was one of the ones on that list that wasn't on the list that I liked. And of the ones on the list, I would definitely put Casino Royale in the top 10.
Yeah,
I wouldn't say it's my favorite, but I would say it was one of the top five most enjoyable movie experiences the last couple of years.
And I would say, and I haven't seen Children of Men, and this is on my list to whine about. Because it opened last week.
Yep.
Wanted to see it then, but my wife wants to see it, and it's hard to get our schedules to mesh up so that we don't see a movie at the same time. Decide we're going to see it this weekend. I go on Friday. I go into Fandango, start poking around. It's playing in one theater in Seattle.
Yeah.
The Pacific Place, which is downtown Seattle. We live in the suburbs, and it's not convenient. I was so irritated. I'm like, okay, well, Pan's Labyrinth is opening. I wonder if that's showing nowhere in Seattle.
Oh, yeah, and
limited release.
And not only that, it's had previews in Seattle, because I've seen three critics from Seattle put it on their top 10 list and say, oh, by the way, it's opening in 3 weeks. So, in other words, they're actually, you know, critics actually have seen it. Seattle critics have seen it. It's just not opening yet. And I'm thinking, why? Why? It's getting all kinds of press. Why are you waiting? What is this whole stupid slow rollout thing? The thing that made me mad about the Children of Men is they basically, I think the when they give these exclusive runs of these kind of artier movies, they treat each like large metro area media market as a single area. And so Seattle, the Seattle Everett area apparently is considered one area. So if they have a movie like that, it only plays in Seattle. They never say, well, you know, that's too far for somebody else. And there's Art House Lovers or whatever. I don't even know. I don't think it's an art house movie, but they just say it's only Seattle. And it kills me because I don't want to go to downtown Seattle to see a movie. The only time I do is like if I'm in the mood to go to downtown Seattle, but just to see a movie, I hate that.
If they're only going to open it in one theater, that they're going to do it in downtown Seattle.
But why can't they do it in two theaters?
Well, that's a different argument, though.
They've done that before. I mean, I remember when they had that weird, that little Danny Boyle movie, Millions, a couple years ago, and they opened that in like a theater in downtown Seattle, and they opened it at the Alderwood Megaplex.
Well, I agree. That makes more logistical sense, but if you're only going to open it in one, I understand why you're choosing downtown Seattle.
I just don't agree with the only opening in one thing.
Well, like I said, different argument.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was just extremely frustrating to have your heart set on, you know, I really want to see this movie. I've heard great things. I can't wait.
Yeah.
And then you're stymied.
Yeah.
Oh, that just kills me. I was so mad.
Yeah, I hear you.
And then, since I'm discussing this sort of thing anyway, my Xbox gets bricked.
Yeah, what happened there?
We watched a DVD on it Friday night
instead
of going to see Children of Men. And then Saturday morning, I get up, go down to put in Test Drive Unlimited, my new addiction.
Yep.
And I get the three flashing red lights. And I go through, you know, I log on to Xbox.com, go through their support. Their support article is essentially, make sure that the power supply light is green. If it's yellow, do this. If it's red, do this. Okay, now call support.
Jesus.
And then you call support, and they're like, well, have you done all the steps that the website told you to do?
Yeah.
All the steps? I made sure the power supply was green. I unplugged it. I plugged it back in.
Oh, man.
Anyway, so, you know, you call, invariably, you're talking to someone in India.
Yeah.
Who, you know, is just reading from a script, and that's fine. Her, you know, that person's job is to just run through their script.
I've always thought that was weird, though, to the run through a script. Why can't they just... I mean, that stuff we can go through. Why are they? Why do they make somebody else ask you to?
I have sympathy for the side of the equation where customer support deals with idiots.
Yeah.
You know, you're, you know, a lot of people that call in are stupid.
Yeah.
And I understand that you need to make sure that the thing is plugged in first before you move on.
Yep.
I completely understand that. And there's really no way that you can self-select. Smart people call this number. Idiots call this number.
Yeah.
I understand that that doesn't work. That being said, you know, it's the beginning of a holiday weekend. I wanted to spend a lot of time playing video games, and I can't.
Yeah.
I am, oh.
Did you notice, though, that the one good thing about the Wii, Sony PSP thing, or Sony PlayStation 3 thing, was that it prompted Microsoft to change their warranty?
Oh, yeah.
So I thought that was fantastic.
Which is good, because I think I'm 4 or 5 months in, which was past the original warranty.
Yeah, it used to be a 90-day warranty, which, given the number of people like yourself that take very good care of their machines and it just dies, that seems appalling that they would have a 90-day, oh, it's a one-year warranty, and they've retroactively extended it to anybody in the back, which is great.
Which
great
is,
for me, because I don't treat my things as well, and it probably will brick on its own some point. Yeah, and I have till November.
You know, and kudos to them. On the other hand, I'm pissed because I can't play the thing.
Yeah.
You know, and also I had to go downstairs, drag up my old DVD player.
Yep.
And you know, go through an RCA connection. So now the quality, because now it doesn't look as good on my HDTV, and it's just not satisfying. And I understand this is all like whining about what are largely inconsequential problems.
Oh, the world we live in.
But, you know, as more and more things get concentrated onto the Xbox, you know, what if I was hardcore enjoying the Xbox Live videos and movies, and like, then my TV viewing would have been screwed this weekend as well.
Yep.
So it kind of made me think, okay, not that I was really seriously considering Xbox Live for videos over iTunes when eventually I dive into the downloads pool, but suddenly having it be a little more, not all consolidated, makes more sense.
Yeah. Well, I feel for you, dude. There's nothing worse than a big holiday weekend, got some time off, and literally you're completely stymied. All of a sudden,
there are plenty of things worse, but in my shallow little universe of this weekend, there's nothing worse. Okay. I did, however, see The Good German last week.
Oh, yeah?
I saw it Christmas Eve.
Yeah?
Quite a very interesting film. I would, you know, almost call it enjoyable.
Really?
It's not that it was bad at all, but it's, you find yourself feeling like, I kind of wish, I understand they're going for this whole 40s milieu genre. And you realize that unless you're in a specific mood, I'm more geared towards today's movies.
Yeah.
But that's fine, because I think he did a really good job. I think for what he was aiming for, he being Steven Soderbergh, he nailed it. I think he really did a fantastic job of achieving his goal.
Yeah.
And I do think it's a pretty good movie.
Well, I was thinking about that movie. I was thinking there's been quite a few experiments in the last couple of years where people do that, where they essentially take a modern, they literally try to make a movie of a certain genre or style that has gone way out of fashion. I was thinking of Down with Love, that Ewan McGregor, Renee Zellweger thing, which was like a Doris Day, Rock Hudson comedy. And I thought it was really well done. I actually enjoyed it. What were some others? There were some others out there. There was this weird one called Man of the Century that came out a couple of years ago, which it basically took a guy like a 1920s Harold Lloyd everyman guy, like, you know, some guy that would talk like, that's the cat's meow, hey honey, you know, and talk like that, but they made him live in the late 1990s and experience the world, but he's got like the attitudes and thoughts of like a 1930s, you know, Hollywood character. And it was kind of a fun experiment. It didn't really work as a movie, but it was a fun experiment. But I like it when they try. Oh, and the other one was that, what was that one with Dennis Quaid and Julianne Moore? And it was like an old Douglas Sirk melodrama, like Imitation of Life. And it got great reviews. I just could not bring myself to see it because I find those, I understand why critics love those old super melodramas from the 60s and 50s by Douglas Sirk. I have no interest in seeing them, and I had no interest in seeing a modern version of one at all. It just like scared the heck out of me. And The Good German, I'll probably see it on DVD, but my initial interest was like, I don't know, I don't want to be transported into that world with modern actors speaking like they're in the Carol Reed's The Third Man or something. I just wasn't interested.
The dialogue actually was fine. It didn't come across as being overtly different.
Really?
Are you allowed to eat chicken biscuits?
It's fake stuff.
You sure?
Yeah, I looked.
Okay. As I question Richard's vegetarian bona fides.
And even if it is, it's what do they call it? Like the freegan kind of thought. They appear, I eat.
Okay.
Actually, I've never done that before.
Anyway, I thought George Clooney was good. And then what was interesting about it, you haven't seen it. I won't reveal plot points. The last week's The Treatment was Steven Soderbergh being interviewed by Elvis Mitchell.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet. Mainly
talking about The Good German, but also some other stuff. And it's interesting, you know, you hear them discussing themes and whatnot and this and that, and you realize, wow, I didn't get that at all. Clearly, I'm a moron.
Right.
I can't believe they put this much effort into trying to convey this one theme or thought, and it completely escaped me.
So why are you thinking you're a moron? Why aren't you thinking they just didn't do a good job conveying it?
No, it's...
I mean, I love Soderbergh and all,
because that happens to me a lot, actually, when I listen to...
Yeah, but you're pretty with it on these things.
Honestly, there are times, you know, when there's a lot of subtext I miss, or overarching themes or things where it relates to certain other things, because like I've never been to film school. I've really never taken serious film classes. And to some degree.
Yeah, but ultimately films are for consumers. And if they have a point that they're really trying to make, if people aren't getting it, if it's a point they want people to get. Now, sometimes it's like, no, that's a theme. I don't really care if people get it. That's one thing. But it's a point they expect people to get, you should be getting it.
Yeah, on the other hand, I think a good portion of that works on a subconscious level.
Oh.
And then you just kind of come away thinking either it worked or it didn't work for various reasons. And that can be reinforced by stuff that's going on subconsciously. But, what was I going to say? One thing I really enjoyed was the score. Because I noticed it, but not in a bad way. Normally, if I notice a score, I harp on it. But in this case, I thought the score was brilliant. Because it really nailed the time period. It didn't sound out of date, necessarily. I don't know. It did a good job of sounding appropriate and really reinforcing the movie, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
One thing that Soderbergh mentioned in his interview was that with every movie, he tries to destroy his last movie. You know, do something completely different. And I could think, wow, that's really great. What was Ocean's 12? Were you just destroying good movies there?
Well, him and Clooney have both said that the Ocean's franchises have completely allowed them to do everything they want. He's probably assuming that
Elvis didn't call him. On I know. It.
Well, he's probably assuming that we all agree. The unspoken second part of that statement was, yeah, I destroy every movie. Oh, except for those Ocean's things. Those are my cash cow. That's how a little money tree I shake. So we're not talking about that. That's what he's saying. Although I'm looking forward to Ocean 13. I liked the preview.
I was going to say, it's a really good, the Elvis Mitchell treatment is a really good one. And I strongly recommend you listen to it.
I'll have to listen to it.
Because you're a hardcore Soderbergh fan.
Yep.
It was interesting. He was talking about how he doesn't like writing. To him, it's not, you know, a journey of expansiveness and getting ideas down. It's just a chore that needs to be done.
Hmm.
Not that he, you know, disavows writers. He just doesn't like the act himself. And he said the last time he did it, which was on Solaris, he says now with hindsight, Solaris really would have benefited from his bringing on another writer to help flesh things out, which is interesting because I don't think of Solaris as poorly written. I think it is very specifically written to get across the themes he was trying to get across. And in that instance, I liked the way he did it.
Yeah.
I probably would have liked it other ways as well, but I didn't come out of that really, you know, I think I'm one of the few people that came out of that really having enjoyed the movie.
Oh, I love that movie. And you're right. It didn't make any money. They spent a lot of money on that movie. It was funny. It was, you know, there was a Russian movie by Tarkovsky that was made in the 60s, late 60s, that this is a remake of, the original Solaris. And I finally saw that on TV the other day. And people's knock against this Solaris, which that it was ponderous, they weren't quite sure what the themes were and other stuff. Oh my God, the original one was that times 10. And you could see why Soderbergh was so moved by it. But it was, so he's compelled to explore similar themes, and he did it way better than the other ones. But you could just see it was basic, like a ponderous, I mean, Soderbergh's movie was like a Russian movie almost. And the mood of the movie was, I think, hard for people to get to, but man, I wish they'd given it a chance because it was just, it was powerful movie. It was a great movie. Anyway, I digress.
Okay.
I enjoyed that movie. And I always think back to it. Some people think of that as like, that's when Soderbergh, you know, he had the string of greatness and then that's where he screwed everything up. And I'm thinking, no, I count that in the string of greatness. I'm not saying there's others he didn't screw up, but that was a pretty good movie.
So we saw the trailer for Fantastic Four 2, The Rise of the Silver Surfer.
Yeah.
Now this, it's one of those that takes a full scene from the movie, which we are in favor of.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Like, and yet,
it's not a good scene.
Well, it's funny. It seems like on Ain't It Cool, they're very excited about it.
I don't know.
I'm hampered by a couple of things. Well, one, it's like starts with the wedding scene of Reed and Sue.
Yeah.
The Mr. Fantastic, the stretchy guy, and the Invisible Woman. And the preacher was Brian Posehn.
Yeah, that was cool.
I mean, I know he's a geek, a comic book geek, but to me that seemed kind of random and yet cool.
It is cool. He's getting more and more work, which is cool. Loved him. So
anybody connected with Mr. Show,
exactly.
I'm a huge fan of. So there was that. But then, you know, the Silver Surfer shows up and the Human Torch goes off and chases him, and essentially that's the scene. And the Silver Surfer, I guess, looks, you know, I just watched it on my laptop, so it's not like I saw it in glorious high definition on a big screen, but he kind of looked, it's a metallic-y, reflective-y T2.
To me, it looked, him on the surfboard, it didn't look really all that great. There was like him going through this tunnel, and I didn't think it looked all that great, but the thing that I know nothing about the Silver Surfer. The only thing I know is he's sort of an existentialist anti-hero. To some extent, he's sort of like the angels in that German movie Wings of Desire or something. He just sort of observes and then participates.
How does he
fight crime, or what's his thing?
He started out I think it's one of the 60s era creations. Anyway, he started out as the Herald of Galactus.
Yep.
Galactus is a gigantic bad guy who goes around eating planets, basically consuming them for their energy. That's his energy source.
Yeah.
So he has a herald which goes and finds him planets to eat.
Yep.
And so Silver Surfer, whose name is Norrin Rad, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
He agreed to be, and there have been multiple heralds, he agreed to be the Herald of Galactus if Galactus would spare his own planet.
Yep.
So then he's turned into this, he's given powers by Galactus to go find other planets that he can eat. And I guess the Silver Surfer came to Earth, scouting it out as a potential energy source. And then I don't know what happened. He interacted with the Fantastic Four. He decided to not be a herald anymore and fight Galactus, something along those lines. I mean, this is all that all happened in the 60s. So, and he's been a character that's been around ever since, essentially a good guy, I think. And I'm a little and he has, I think he has pretty vast array of powers, and yet I don't really know what they are.
Yeah.
But all I can do is look at that surfboard and think, surfboard.
He's on a surfboard.
And it's one of those concepts which, you know, okay, it's in a comic. You kind of give things a little more freedom in a comic. You suspend your disbelief to a greater degree, especially when you're a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
But I'm having difficulty envisioning how they successfully bring this to the screen with any degree of as much degree of seriousness as is required in a Fantastic Four movie.
Well, did you see the first one yet?
Nope.
Yep. It's, I actually kind of enjoyed it. It's real comic booky, but not nudge, nudge, wink, wink. It's just broad without being jokey about it. And then this one will probably be more of the same. I actually kind of enjoyed it, even though it's clearly one of the lesser ones.
That's perfectly fine. Yeah. This is such an out there thing, you know, a world devouring gigantic alien, especially when you look at his getup. It's this purple and black. And I mean, it works in comics because it was a Jack Kirby. Jack Kirby was the artist that came up with the concept of how these things looked. And it is a very specific 60s style.
Yeah.
And how they adapt that will be interesting. But the concept is so comic booky and so over the top. It'll be interesting to see how they approach it. And yet, you know, you've got sort of the same reaction to Transformers, and suddenly we're taking that a lot more seriously than we were before we saw that last trailer.
Yep. Have you seen the new trailer for the new Ghost Rider trailer?
I think I have.
It was, I'm not sure what to make of that.
I saw the first look thing that they show in front of the previews.
Yeah.
So I saw that.
They had a trailer, and I'm not sure what to make of it. To me, the more it, you know, what's his name is playing is Nick. Such a, he's playing in that really, every once in a while be in a movie where he's super broad and tough, and he's sort of playing it that way. And I'm not sure if it's going to be horrible or good. It started to look more and more like those Grindhouse things that Tarantino's putting on, where it's really broad, really violent. If it's that way, maybe I'll like it. I'm not watching the Seahawk game, but you got to turn around and watch a replay for this.
You're sure you're not watching the Seahawk game?
It's not. This is Jacksonville and Kansas City.
Well, dude, I can watch that game.
Just blocked a punt and recovered it in the end zone. Sweet.
You know, there have been a ton of blocked kicks this year.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
I've never seen this many blocked field goals.
It's hard to tell if
the blocked punt seems about average, although you don't usually see it returned for a score.
Yeah. Yeah, but anyway, so the Ghost Rider, I'm not sure what I think of it. I have no knowledge of Ghost Rider, the thing. And there's some really stupid things on there where, like, he's driving up over the top of a bridge over, like, the support structure of a bridge and stuff. But, you know, it might be good. I don't know. What do you think about Ghost Rider? Are you at all interested in seeing it?
Only a little bit. I mean, if it's one of those, there would have to be nothing else playing in the theater at that time for me to see it. Ghost Rider, the comic book, has had mixed success.
Yeah.
It's one of those, they relaunch, it goes for a year, they cancel it. They relaunch, it goes for a year, they cancel it. I think the current run is still ongoing. It hasn't been canceled yet. I don't know if that's just because they're holding on for the movie.
For the movie coming out, yeah. I didn't realize this. This is that stupid, horrible movie. What is it? The Cleaner? But the scene they just panned across was clearly the Space Needle. So it must be another one of those filmed in Vancouver, takes place in Seattle movies.
Well, they come and they'll do a day of helicopter shoots. And
I know. I told you that one movie I saw, the Crush, where they didn't even bother to do the day of helicopter shoots. They shot Vancouver as if it was Seattle, and they had one snippet of that little restaurant that's in Vancouver that looks, the top, it looks kind of like the Space Needle. I think they had it like for a tenth of a second because they thought people might go, oh, did I just see the Space Needle? And then boom, they're off.
Well, that Battle of Seattle film that they're making about the WTO riots.
I know.
They spent about 2 or 3 days filming in downtown Seattle and the rest in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And you're just like, the irony in that is insane.
I know. Although, you know, the thing about that movie, which I'm kind of excited about, was they were saying that movie's like a $10 million movie. And it's got big stars in it. Charlize Theron, who literally makes like $8, $10 million a movie. So clearly a bunch of people are doing this for the love of the movie. But the thing about that movie that stunned me was, was that they filmed it right in the middle of holiday season on a busy shopping weekend and closed down a bunch of streets. I was stunned that they did that in Seattle. Why they couldn't have waited 2 weeks when shopping was over.
I don't know, but I can, if you're part of the Seattle film office, there is such a thing, you've got to be bending over backwards to get any action in your city.
I totally agree. And I'm glad they did it.
But
I think
you're right.
I was just surprised because it was literally a week and a half before the end of,
It wasn't quite that. It was, but it was early December, wasn't
no,
it?
No, no. It was mid-December.
No, it wasn't that late. No. You're wrong.
Am I wrong? Okay, well, I thought it was mid-December.
In that it was the holiday shopping season, yeah. And probably a little too close for retailers' comfort.
But, yeah. Yeah, but anyway, I was just surprised they didn't just wait a little bit. But then, you know, maybe they couldn't.
You know, it's funny, as we kind of digress into this Vancouver thing, I have a couple of Vancouver comments.
Yep.
There was, in the pilot episode of Studio 60, whether or not they should take this TV job versus shooting the movie, and, well, you should shoot the movie, you know, shoot it in Vancouver and save money, and they go off on this, you know, I'm sick of movies in Vancouver. It looks like Boston, California. It's everywhere. I'm sick of seeing Vancouver.
Yep.
And it was kind of this, where did that come from? And you're like, Aaron Sorkin apparently is just decided to rage against that. And yep. I'm like, good for you, buddy.
I did like the Boston, California line.
And the other one was the last episode of Battlestar Galactica before they went on their holiday break. They were talking about how they went an hour and a half, 2 hours away to shoot at, I want to call it Canloops.
Yeah, Camloops.
Camloops, that's it. Yep. I knew you knew where it was.
Been there.
They went to shoot there because they felt that they had shot all of the exteriors they could in and around Vancouver without repeating themselves.
Yeah.
They needed something different. And Ronald Moore says, you know, it costs more because once you reach a certain circle around the thing, you're into overtime and you're into transportation costs with the crew. Yeah. But the other thing he said was, ironically, we go to find something different, and it looks like Vasquez Rock outside of L.A.,
yeah.
which is somewhere famously, and I will purposefully use that word, famously that productions around L.A. go to use to find something that looks a little different.
Yeah.
Vasquez Rock being where Kirk fought the Gorn in Star Trek, and Bill and yeah. Ted, and even Mr. Show went out to do that Jesus Christ Superstar yep. thing.
Yeah, there's a bunch of famous. It's like
the irony of all that is
that ranch where they used to film MASH at, and it's like the Mansons used to hang out there, and it's been filmed everywhere. It's filled in for Vietnam and for Korea and everything. It's just outside L.A. and it's like so much of our view. That's why I remember watching. To some extent, it's true, but I remember watching. Full Metal Jacket, which was filmed all in London, but I remember looking, Kubrick did not like leaving England at all, so he filmed it all in England. But there were scenes there, and it just seemed so desolate, and in Saigon, especially, like just seemed barren because they imported a couple palm trees, and I'm going, God, it just looks terrible. You know, it doesn't look like the SHIT that you're seeing in Platoon and stuff. And my dad goes, I don't know, that looked kind of like what Vietnam looked like when I was there. And then I realized all of my view of Vietnam was tempered by all these movies filmed in the Philippines.
Oh, that's a very interesting point.
Heavy duty jungle. And it's not so much. Vietnam was not quite like that. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting.
I would never have guessed a Full Metal Jacket was shot in London.
Yeah, it was filmed entirely in London. Every movie after The Shining, and The Shining, I think, was filmed totally in London too, but it was, in fact, he didn't film any of the exterior. So I think the last movie he did outside of England was in the 60s. Cause he did not like to fly, did not like to leave. So 2001, totally in London, Clockwork Orange, The Shining, every one of them, even Eyes Wide Shut, which is supposedly takes place in New York, the exteriors and interiors totally in London.
Well, what was I going to say? Well, and the exteriors for the boot camp stuff.
Yep.
I've never been to Paris Island, but that looked like Paris Island.
Yeah, it really felt like it. Yep.
Which is interesting.
And totally London.
I knew a guy who was a Marine, a recent Marine, he's not an older guy. And he said the boot camp stuff, spot on.
Yeah, my brother said he had pretty much gotten out of boot camp at the time. He goes, yep, that felt exactly like boot camp. One exception, he said, they would never hit us. But,
yeah,
but he
they
said,
can't now.
But. Yeah, but he said every other thing, that felt like I was right back in boot camp. The way they yell, the way they do it.
Oh, the point where, like, the guy I knew, his name was Tim, he said, you know, if they caught you spitting, you'd say, are you hawking a loogie on my island? You picked that up and you put it in your pocket. I mean, just... And it was funny because I saw another comment somewhat recently about how a lot of people's thinking of the Marines is based in that film, because that's all they know of the Marines is that film. Yep. And yet all the Marines I've ever met say the boot camp portion is spot on accurate.
You know what's funny about that?
And when
that,
the other thing about that, every man, just about every man I've ever known can quote like all of Arlie Ermey's lines.
I know.
And they've seen that. They know it. They love it.
Yep.
And it's one of those, not every man, but just about every guy knows that section.
And you know what's funny? When that first came out, it was horrifying, and it was beautifully done because you started to laugh with Arlie Ermey as he's screaming at this guy until very pointedly at one time he's yelling at Private Pyle, and then he hits him and tries to choke him. And it was so beautiful because you're watching this movie and you're kind of laughing along with Arlie Ermey. You're going, this is crazy. And then you realize that how awful it is what he's doing to this guy, but he's made you identify with Arlie Ermey. Then he's put Arlie Ermey in a position to really brutalize this guy, and you feel really sick. It was really good. So that first time I watched that movie going, oh my God, that's holy geez. It was awful. It was brutal. And then the next time you go, damn, do those lines again. And by the 100th time, you know, like everybody, they love that movie and they forget the original thing. That's like, it's sort of the old adage. They say how it's impossible to make an anti-war war movie because invariably, no matter how brutal you make it, it's going to come across as exciting to people. And that was a movie, you know, very similar to that. It just was exciting.
Oh, if I can't see any highlights.
So anyway, what's next on your list there, dude?
Well, actually, there was something about Full Metal Jacket that always bothered me was the fact that in training camp, they were using M14s. And when they switched to the in theater stuff, they had M16s. And that always bothered me. And a couple weeks ago, I saw a thing on the History Channel about the history of the M16.
Yep.
And about how, well, actually that is feasible because there was...
Yeah, that's right, when they were introducing it.
I didn't realize that they were introducing it in the middle of the war.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, why would you train someone on one rifle and then get them in and they're using another rifle? That made no sense. But there actually is a time period when that feasibly could have happened. So I no longer hold that as a I don't understand moment.
And I, being pretty gun illiterate, didn't even notice.
As anti-war as I am, I still have that bit of boy in me that likes guns. It's a problem. Well, it's not a serious problem. It's one of those mental, I can't believe I don't like war and yet am fascinated by guns.
Yep.
All right. So an emailed comment to us. Did you know that they're filming War Games 2?
Yeah, I heard about that.
Apparently nobody from the original has anything to do with it.
Not John Badham, not anything, and who knows. That first movie was a uniquely great movie. Very well done.
I haven't seen it in a long time, but I saw it a lot when I was a kid.
Yeah, I did too. They must have been playing it like on cable or something. Because I seem to remember seeing it in... I can remember so many things like that dweeby character and then the computer programmers and the other guy going, Mr. Potato Head, Mr. Potato Head, and just little things like that. I have such a very specific memory of that movie.
The two missile techs going down to the silo talking about meditation and Om Mani Padme Hum.
Yeah,
you're right. I didn't realize, you know, of course it was set around Seattle and the Falcon
scientist. And actually filmed in Seattle. When it was, so.
The Falcon scientist, Dr. Falcon, lived on one of the, well, I don't know if it was a San Juan, but one of the islands in that area, in the Puget Sound itself, called Goose Island, doesn't actually exist.
Yeah, and it doesn't even sound like a San Juan Island.
You know, and I remember him talking about, there was a point when he was saying, you know, I purposefully live somewhere near a target, so if there's a nuclear war, I'll be killed instantly, and all I can think of is Boeing.
Oh, here we're one of the huge targets because Fort Lewis, but specifically Boeing. You're exactly right because of that. But Seattle was always considered, and there's all the Trident nuclear missile base, which he would be close to in Bangor. Seattle was considered.
There wouldn't be any if there was a. There's rarely that many subs in base at once.
Seattle was considered, but it's the support structure and everything. But Seattle was definitely considered one of the prime ones. You know, it's funny you bring that up, that a couple of days ago, some guy from the KGB in the Soviet Union or somewhere had a press conference where he was presenting basically the 1980 Soviet war plan for what they assumed nuclear war would look like, where their strikes were going and where worse, or it was weird and it was kind of creepy looking, and it was interesting. Basically, over a 5-day period, Poland would cease to exist. And but what was interesting is throughout the whole Cold War, they always talked about Berlin being, this is ground zero. The minute war happens, Berlin is toast. You know, my dad and all these other Cold Warriors that were stationed in Berlin knew full well they would last 10 minutes because there was literally a million troops stationed outside of West Berlin that would immediately have overtaken Berlin. So the people that were there knew full well that if something ever happened, there wasn't a lot they could do about it. They were there more symbolically. Well, what was interesting is looking at the map is there's no nuclear weapons going anywhere near West Berlin. Ironic, because of course there's a million Soviet troops just outside of it. So they weren't going to kill each other's troops. And I thought, wow, ironically, it never occurred to me that if there was a nuclear war, first of all, it would be awful, but the safest place to be to not get hit by nuclear weapons would have been Berlin. And it never even occurred to me. But anyway, around Seattle, it was, there was a lot of things. You know what I loved about war games is there's so many movies, like literally 2 seconds after they're done, that have something to do with computers. They feel instantly dated and bad. And there's a lot that's dated and bad about this, but it still works so completely in the context of that movie that it's just a joy to watch. I mean, I just love that. And that whole set, that NORAD set, was such a great set so well done. I mean, it's just a great movie. And I look at that and I go, God, whatever happened to Dabney Coleman? I mean, you know, all these actors that love so much.
What was that series about the sports writer?
Yeah, the Buffalo Bill. It was awesome.
Buffalo Bill?
Yeah, he was in two. He was in two series, but the sports writer was Buffalo. Well, no, there was the TV show, and then he was an actual sports writer, which people conflate. There was Buffalo Bill, and then there was another show.
Well, yeah, that's not the one I'm thinking of.
Slap Maxwell story.
That was it.
Yeah, and they're great. And then
I figure, you know, an actor probably makes enough money from one series that they never have to work again if they don't want to.
Well, not those. Those things never made it into. I don't know. Slap Maxwell lasted one season.
Yeah. Well, you always compare but it's interesting when you think about that, because the standard of, you're saying, well, if I had the money that they got from that series, I'd be set for life, but it's at your own standard of living.
Yeah, that's
true. Like, you think of a house as costing whatever, you know, your current situation is. You don't think that, you know, you need a $2 million house, which requires a lot more upkeep. Yep. Anyway, let's move on. Everyone, we're a little late making fun of this, but since it is vaguely entertainment industry, the Time Magazine Person of the Year.
Oh, God.
What a joke. Ugh. I mean, I never care anyway. It's not like I read Time Magazine or give a rat's patoot, to use a Harry Potter MASH phrase, who the Person of the Year is. And yet, this stupid it's you thing, what a cop-out. Who cares?
At least The Daily Show made fun of the interview with
Soledad O'Brien. And that's what made me want to talk about it. Ugh. Soledad O'Brien, a CNN reporter.
Yep.
Apparently one of their biggies, because I hear her name a lot.
Yep.
I stopped watching CNN a long time ago. The only time I watch CNN is actually if something blows up, i.e. 9/11, yep, or it's election night. That's the only times I watch CNN now. They've got Soledad O'Brien interviewing the editor-in-chief or whoever it was, the publisher of Time Magazine. And they do this whole reveal thing, like he's got a blanket around it and he whisks it away and it's you.
And of course, she knows ahead of time what it is. It's not news. She's basically leading an infomercial. It was really painful.
It was horrible. Horrible.
Oh. It made me really mad because it was just awful. And then, and I could care less about the Man of the Year, but ultimately the Man of the Year used to be the person who had the most impact. So Hitler was the Man of the Year. And I said, they simply don't do that now at all. You know, how in 2001, Osama bin Laden, for instance, wasn't the Man of the Year. You know, they simply don't do it because they know people don't understand, but which is fine. But to transform it into this Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue excuse to sell things, I hate.
Well, yeah, and it hasn't been, you know, last year it was Bill and Melinda Gates and Bono.
Yeah.
So that's not one person. Then it was, you know, those year it was whistleblowers. Yep. That's not a person.
Then it was the computer.
And then it was the soldier. You're right. And apparently that year was actually supposed to be Steve Jobs, but they heard so many stories about him being a jerk at work, they didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's been a cop-out forever.
Yeah.
Well, forever. And it's just this latest one just illustrates what a joke it is.
Yeah.
And you're right. Watching both The Daily Show and The Colbert Report just rip into it was brilliant.
Good.
Absolutely brilliant. which leads into my next thing.
Yep.
I watched a, it's been a slow week at work, so I've been able to work while watching YouTube stuff.
Yeah.
And there was a Colbert interview he did at the Harvard School of Politics, the Kennedy School of Politics at Harvard. And it was a really fascinating.
King's School of Government.
You're right. It was really fascinating, about an hour, 20 minutes of him answering questions and being interviewed, talking about, you know, his character and how he thought there was one, you know, were there any Congress people that, you know, what was your worst interview? And I think he said Henry Waxman, because he thought during the interview that Henry Waxman was getting the joke. Yeah. And turns out later he wasn't at all in on the joke.
Oh, that's too bad.
But just, you know,
Waxman's like kind of a liberal hero. So from a personal level, that must have been
just
hard.
Yeah. Just talking about how he approaches his character and how he fits into the greater zeitgeist, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, and I would recommend anybody listening, and both to you, you know, go to YouTube and search for this thing. Or it might have even been a Google video. I don't remember. It doesn't really matter. But it was a really good insight into how he approaches his show and how he approaches interviews. And, you know, it's really quite interesting. You know, I've had a chance to watch some of the episodes from the past few weeks lately. And did you see the Decembrists one?
Yes.
I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, basically he stepped out of his normal format because he'd gone to this whole thing about the green screen challenge, and this band called the Decembrists had their own green screen challenge.
Yep.
You know, make a video of our playing this song. So Colbert called him out. They challenged him to a guitar solo.
To a thrash
off. A shred off. Yep. And so they were playing it up. And it finally culminated in this episode where they had this, the guitarist from the Decembrists come on and do a guitar solo for a minute. And then they have Colbert start to play, pretend to hurt his hand. And then he introduces Peter Frampton to play as himself.
And you know, it was great. I felt bad though when he pulled out the five-headed guitar. I go, "Oh, that's Rick Nielsen's from Cheap Trick."
Yeah,
and I knew Rick Nielsen had written the theme song for Colbert. But he was like doing it and reading the cue cards, and he called him Nick Nielsen accidentally. Fortunately, later he called him Rick Nielsen. But I immediately go, "Oh, he called him Nick Nielsen," but he did call him Rick Nielsen later. But yeah, it was fun, very meta, very cool, and but they had all kinds of celebrities, which they cannot do this too often. It occurred to me, but they had the new governor of New York,
Elliot Spitzer,
who's a cool guy. They had Henry Kissinger on
via satellite. There's a guy who looked like he had no idea what he was doing.
Yeah, but I think he's a smart guy. I think he understands
either being an idiot or being out of it. But
so while I liked that in that context, I worry too much about it becoming like a Saturday Night Live where politicians come on and not get ribbed on or whatever. I like the oral format, and I don't like them too much being directly overtly part of the process. Going out of their character. I would prefer them not to do that too much. Although I really liked it in the context of this.
I get where you're coming from, but I loved the whole thing.
I did too. I did too.
Judging from this interview, Colbert, you know, and his staff really know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on. I just saw something this morning. The National Science Teachers Association has refused to accept 50,000 free copies of An Inconvenient Truth.
Yeah, that's a couple weeks old.
To show in schools.
Just to give them out free.
Right. And their reason was they don't like to take sides in things, and yet apparently they've taken plenty of donations from ExxonMobil.
Absolutely.
From oil companies, and even showed a video about how cool oil is.
Exactly. And the taking sides, as they point out in Inconvenient Truth, it's not a side. This is 100% of the scientific community, basically.
And I saw a thing on the Discovery Channel last night while we were flipping around, and it was basically last days on Earth. You know, here's the various ways the Earth could end.
Yep.
Real upper of a show.
Yeah.
And the number one thing was global warming.
Yep.
And they start talking about the Greenland ice sheet. I don't think they had discussed this newest Canadian ice sheet, which detached. And they're interviewing Al Gore and showing portions of An Inconvenient Truth, and had some scientists on, basically saying, you know what, everyone agrees this is a problem. You know, there are six you know, people which think it's not, and they're completely uncredible. And it was interesting because outside of an inconvenient truth, I really hadn't seen anything in a TV medium addressing the fact that, you know what, the deniers are they're uncredible.
Absolutely not. Yeah, just beyond. It's just,
I had seen it in articles. I hadn't seen it addressed on TV.
They take advantage of the natural challenge of media, which is media tries to say there's two sides to a story, right, and they plan them equally.
Have balance.
Yeah, balance. And what they don't realize is if it's 99% one and 1% the other, they treat it as 50-50.
Exactly. And you know? They had one guy saying, look, it's like you've got people that are denying the Holocaust.
Yeah,
it's the same kind of people. Nobody is seriously denying the Holocaust, except you will always have Holocaust.
So do you
deniers.
Have to treat them 50%? Now, I don't know if you saw this, but over at the Grand Canyon, a bunch of creationists are going crazy saying the Grand Canyon is 1,000 years old. So, or like 6,000 years old. So anyway, they're putting this book on there about the Grand Canyon being sold at the Grand Canyon gift shop, about the Grand Canyon being created by, you know, God 6,000 years ago and stuff. And people are going, why is this in here? And the guy, the head of the Park Service, going, well, it's kind of like a library. We don't, you know, discriminate. And as they pointed out, no, the exact charge of the Park Service is books have to be carefully vetted, and they're not like a library. They have to pass scientific scrutiny, and they have to present the best case of scrutiny. And they pointed out of the 20 books that, you know, were proposed through there, they were all turned down except for this one about creationism. And then they found out later that they promised, well, we'll have a deep, thorough investigation. And some of the people asked for a freedom of information request to find out about this investigation, found out they did nothing. They literally lied, said, we're going to have this book in here, and then later said, well, we'll investigate why we're having this, and they didn't do it at all. It's appalling.
Not only that, but apparently if you ask a park ranger or a scientist who works at the Grand Canyon that's employed by the Park Service, or I'm not sure exactly how the federal entity, but if you ask them how old the Grand Canyon is, they cannot comment.
Yeah, they'll equivocate. You know, somebody pointed out that this one guy had this great analogy. He says, you know, this is basically as if Park Service were, when you go to Yosemite and they ask about Old Faithful, they say, I mean, with a straight face, they were explaining, no, that's Satan's nostrils. That's angry Satan spitting up nostrils, because that's the exact same, you know, look or what they're arguing.
And the other part of it, which was, okay, well, why is it just Christianity being represented then?
Yeah.
You know, why not the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster and its creation myth involving the Grand Canyon? Why is it just this one religion? So, of course, you know, everyone knows what's going on. It's just this veneer of absurdity.
Yeah.
Anyway, and
it's painful to realize, even after all the other things that have clearly people have rebelled against, that stuff is still kind of working its way through the system. And, you know, that's what we get for the last 8 years, six years.
So, you know, hopefully, you know, global warming as a serious issue, I'm seeing addressed more and more.
Yeah.
Whether it's just because I'm visiting specific websites more and more, like Grist or whatever, that sort of preach to the converted, or, you know, but like, look at this Discovery thing I saw last night. It seems like more and more it's becoming a topic of serious discussion.
Yeah. Well, Discovery Channel in particular, they made a commitment. They said, we in the next like 2 years, and they like had an announcement of number of shows that they were going to do specifically relating to global warming.
That's good. You know, you don't want, you know, I don't want our discussion to be too political on an entertainment broadcast, but as it becomes more and more accepted through entertainment, through news, through movies, through, you know, how, you know, Colbert or Daily Show, bringing it up in those venues, more and more people become aware this is a serious problem, and we have a limited amount of time to act before the damage becomes irreversible, or to the point where it accelerates to a point where we can't affect anything versus we can affect some things.
Yep.
So I hope, and, you know, hope that continues.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a random thing we haven't discussed before that is entertainment related. NFL Sunday Ticket.
Yep.
This is the package that DirecTV offers and lets you watch every single football game.
Yeah, my dad has it.
And I read two football columns a week.
Sorry,
pending my time.
Yeah.
And one of them, Tuesday Morning Quarterback on ESPN.com, is constantly, this is one of his pet peeves, that not everybody can get DirecTV, either through, you know, their house isn't oriented to see the satellite correctly. And it's, and because of the fact that the Congress granted monopolies to sports, you know, NFL and, you know, and baseball and football basically are the two he's saying, they've granted monopolies and they've said, you now have to make these games available to the entire country.
Yep.
Well, as it's happened, they're not, because DirecTV has a monopoly on Sunday Ticket. If you don't have DirecTV, you have no avenue for watching these games.
Yep.
And then you tie that into local broadcast rules where, you know, we live in Seattle, we have to see the Seahawks game,
yep.
which generally is fine because people here like the Seahawks. My dad lives near Toledo, Ohio. He is forced to watch Detroit Lions games and Cleveland Browns games. He happens to hate both teams because they both stink out loud.
Yep.
So my dad, except for, depending on the scheduling, he might see one game a week, which isn't those teams.
Yep.
But it's just bringing to the point, or bringing to the fore, the fact, you know, why am, if I live in Detroit, why am I stuck watching Lions games?
Yeah.
It's great that I have the opportunity to, in case I'm a diehard fan and am a masochist and hate myself. But what if I wanted to see a good game?
Yeah.
Unless I buy DirecTV, I'm limited. And so I think from an entertainment perspective, from a monopoly perspective, that is a bad thing.
Yeah.
That package or the ability to watch every game should be available to everyone, not just DirecTV
subscribers. Well, of course, that's Rupert Murdoch's way of saying, let's run Dish Network out of business. So they're not going to be able to, there's practical considerations why it might not be available on cable. But in terms of the satellite thing, they want that exclusivity because people on Dish Network can't have it.
And you know, I'm not about to get DirecTV for that.
Yeah.
A, because it costs, I don't know, 100. What does it cost? What does your dad pay a year for that?
A lot, but not. But it's stunning compared to cable, how cheap it is. But my dad has like everything. They call it the Platinum Package. There's
your dad's
not a
retired and he has the money to do
there's,
it.
There's not a channel he can flip by that he doesn't get.
And more power to him, but that is expensive.
Yeah.
And I, as much as I love football, I don't have the time to watch all those games.
Yeah.
But it's important to me. You know, it's really irritating to my dad that he can't watch the games he wants.
Yeah. And I don't know. I hear what you're saying. By the same token, Sirius has the NFL. XM has Major League Baseball. And it's sort of like you got to figure out what you're.
Well, and this columnist, his name is Greg Easterbrook.
Yep. Greg Easterbrook. He's the big time environmentalist.
Well, yes and no. Sometimes he's right now. He points out good things that the Bush administration does that gets no credit supposedly.
Yeah.
And every time I read one of those now, I kind of go, maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway,
he wrote the book,
A Moment on the Earth.
Yeah. Moment on Earth. Yeah. That's
yeah. Right. It's writing. It's actually in behind my car's front seat.
Yep.
But his point is that the Congress granted these sports organizations monopolies.
Yep.
You cannot form what's the rule? You can't form a football team, but you can. There's very specific rules about what you can form and what you can't in terms of your own football team or league.
Yep.
And he says, you know what? As long as there's a monopoly there, you might. Part of that deal apparently was that it needs to be available to every American.
Yeah.
And so currently no lawmakers have addressed this, but he seems to think that it's coming down the pike, that sooner or later someone's going to say, you know what? The Congress granted you this power and you're not making responsible use of it. You're not doing this. You either need to, you as the NFL, need to either strip the exclusivity from DirecTV or we will.
Yeah.
Now, how serious that is as an imminent threat from Congress, I don't know, but I just thought I'd bring it up, and it's interesting. You don't seem to care that much.
No, I do care. I think that, but the thing with me
not that I thought you would. I'm just
the thing that you know. It's funny that they did. I wouldn't realize it was football, but I know with baseball they granted it a unique place, which was the thing that allowed. That allowed the 7-year what do they call it? The release clause allowed people to go for their own team because prior to that they had a monopoly and if somebody is owned by a team, they had no options. They were completely whatever the owner said. So when you, the free agency clause, so the reason we have a free agency clause was entirely because they have a monopoly. It's because they said, listen, if you have a monopoly, you can't force these people to make $0. You got to be able to do it. Although I didn't realize football had a similar thing. But, you know, there's been leagues come and gone, USFL, the XFL, the that horrible Vince McMahon thing.
Okay, so you must be able to form your own league, but I think there's something about trying to form your own team. You can't form. What happens when we don't do research.
Yeah.
There are some weird rules about what you can and can't do. And maybe it is just baseball. Maybe it's not football, but I thought it was both.
Yeah, no, it might be. I just, from my perspective, to a certain extent, I think you could argue that with a few exceptions, like me in my backyard with a tree that's blocking my line of sight, the vast majority of Americans in the continental United States can get football. Well, they just have to.
Actually, this guy's saying that a goodly number of them can't.
Really? When they passed the omnibus, it was a different telecommunications act, but the challenge with DirecTV satellites was a bunch of, you know, you'd have these codicils in different like communities or condos saying you can't put a satellite dish up, and they made it the law saying that you can, that a condo, an apartment cannot prevent somebody from putting a satellite dish up. So therefore they allowed people to do it. Now that said, practically it might be a challenge because if you live on the wrong side,
what the actual numbers are,
but they can't prevent somebody from doing it legally.
No. It has to do with geography.
Yeah. Yeah, I always thought it was interesting when I was up in Juneau I guess it was like 10 years ago now that I think about it. It was even more than 10 years ago. And satellites, it's weird to think. My dad's had like satellite for a very long time. He's had DirecTV for probably a decade.
Uh-huh.
And I remember when it first came out, it wasn't called DirecTV. They had the satellite. It was like the satellite company, and then they had two content providers on it. One called USSB, which had all the premium movie channels, and then one which was effectively DirecTV. So it was like very much designed to not be monopolistic at the time. Well, then they all got bought out, and the satellite and the content providers are all the same people. It was kind of interesting. But anyway, you go up to Juneau, and you had people that up there, it's probably as far north as you can get and still get DirecTV. And the satellites, you see them on really high poles pointed directly parallel to the ground. So, because that's the only way they could get the satellite. And what was interesting is you could see a definite, you know, anybody that lived behind the mountain could not get DirecTV. So you'd see this group of people that were the haves, because their houses were not blocked by the mountain, and then the have-nots that were blocked by the mountain.
Yeah,
so
I feel very fortunate that I can get the dish stuff.
I feel I tried to set up when I first built this house, and then I found out I had a tree in the way, and I've literally vacillated the last 3 years on, do I want to cut a tree in half for TV? And I'm into trees. I don't want to cut one. But now looking at this tree, because I've been working on my backyard, I'm realizing this tree is sort of diseased and dead. So it's sort of making the decision for me.
I've got a friend that lives in Redmond and lives on the wrong side of a hill.
Yep.
So he gets DirecTV now, but it's a shaky connection because he barely gets it. But he's having both. I think that the HD satellite, I don't think he can get. There was some problem with the... He can't get permission from the local franchisees to get the HD locals package.
Huh.
I don't understand what the specifics of his problem are, even though he's explained it to me in the past. But the only way he can get HD locals, because he's out of sight, he can't use an antenna, he's out of sight, is to get Comcast.
Yeah.
And he hates Comcast as much as I do.
Yep.
And so he has a projector like you have. He's got a projector and a big screen.
Yep.
But he doesn't have HD, and it kills him. It kills him.
Yeah.
And actually, there's been some articles recently on, I don't know if it was Engadget or whatever, talking about, don't react.
I won't.
Okay. Talking about...
Oh, my God!
You're such a jerk.
Sorry.
I know you're just making fun, but... talking about how piss poor the Motorola HD DVR box is that Comcast uses.
That's one I'm about to get.
apparently it's piss poor
because of the quality of the,
just everything about it. Like John has it, the audio drops out on his. Mm. I've got it. My friend Susie has it. She lives in Bellevue and she's had problems where it needs to be turned off and on like 5 times in a day.
That's the one I'm getting. I can't wait.
I mean, Grant, it's only a couple extra bucks a month, but, I don't know. I mean, I've got the Dish version, and I have to say the software on the Dish HD box is so much better than the stuff they had on their older box.
Yeah.
It's so much better.
Maybe they're catching up. I'll tell you, nothing ever.
It's still not as good as TiVo.
Yeah, TiVo's just so great.
But this box hasn't crashed on me once. It hasn't gotten locked into a cycle of like it's continually scrolling up like the old one did.
Yep.
It keeps the picture in the corner while you're looking at the guide.
Yep.
And also while you're scrolling through your recorded stuff. The other one didn't do that. The software is much more robust and I'm very happy with it.
Cool.
And now we're down to, you watched Monster House.
Oh yeah. I bought the DVD. You know, that was the one that a lot of people thought was going to be really successful this summer, and it was okay. It basically tanked though. But I thought it was pretty good, although I didn't think it was as great as a lot of people said, but it was one using the process that basically, what's his name? The director of the new Beowulf,
Zemeckis.
Zemeckis. He pioneered, and this was kind of like more of a proof of concept movie where it was like actors that they were filming, and using motion capture. And I'll tell you the problem they had with the dead eyes of the Polar Express were definitely solved here. I mean, I spent a lot of time focusing on the eyes. Ultimately, the movie is just kind of a dumb concept, but surprisingly adult, like kind of drug humor, clearly underage people drinking beer or talking about it. I was kind of surprised they were doing that in there, but anyway, it's an okay movie. That's literally the only semi-new movie I've seen.
It's funny. I think about Robert Zemeckis or someone like him who, you know, probably his most famous film, Beowulf, and you think, you know, he's been active, but it certainly hasn't achieved the same notoriety since then.
Dude, Forrest Gump.
Okay.
Forrest Gump was way...
You're right.
Forrest Gump made more money.
Forrest Gump was also, how many years ago was that?
It was 94. But the thing about him...
That's over 10 years ago.
Yeah, no.
No, you know, let me finish.
Castaway. Huge. Huge.
Let me finish. But, you know, I don't know if my wife would know who he was. And he sort of, okay, you're bringing up more examples that I had forgotten.
Zemeckis continually manages to, he makes movies that are, the process of making them is innovative, and each time he reinvents them.
But to me, what I was driving at is, you wonder how much money did he realize from like Back to the Future and those,
yep,
and say, okay, I don't need to take a financial risk again in my life. I can take creative risks.
Yep.
And as you point out, Forrest Gump, very successful. I don't remember how successful Castaway was.
Castaway was hugely successful. And that was the one he filmed. Castaway went off, did What Lies Beneath.
Oh, I knew that.
Also very successful. Then went back and finished Castaway. Then he did Polar Express, which it started out not doing well. And then it started making more money and chugging away. And the guy, he's probably, arguably, in terms of financial dollars, probably the most successful director working, because he just makes movies that make a mint and does not have flops, which is funny because you're right. Nobody sees a movie because it's Robert Zemeckis' film. Every time he does it, he's making a movie that is being sold on the movie, has nothing to do with the fact that it's Zemeckis putting it together.
I was approaching that thought more from a, you know, someone who had a big hit and then really you haven't heard from.
And two other big hits he did, Romancing the Stone, huge hit.
I didn't realize that was Robert Zemeckis.
Oh, yeah, Romancing the Stone and then its horrible, horrible sequel.
But you have to wonder, to what degree do they just save the money and say, you know what, that's my living, my retirement money.
Yep.
I can't, you know, I'm set now for life. How do you then approach the rest of your career?
Yeah.
And from his perspective, as you've helped illustrate very successfully, but you have to wonder, like in case of Dabney Coleman, maybe he made enough money off of that series, you know, that he doesn't need to work again. And he said, you know what? As much as I enjoy acting, I've got a family, or I'd rather do this or that. Maybe I'd like to take up alpaca farming.
Yeah.
you know, these guys that they make enough and then they're smart with their money and they don't need to get locked into this cycle of,
yeah, some people are like that. They really do well and save their money, and you go, ah, good for them. They may not be working, but they're living a pretty good life.
Or they've made enough from their one gigantic success, yep. Like Kate Winslet. I don't know what she made from Titanic. I don't know if her deal was big enough that she realized anything or that they gave her money afterwards. I don't think any of them did.
That was the funny thing. Even what's-his-name didn't until later. They decided to give him a gift. He actually gave away his points. Cameron did, and then they gave back to him later. But yeah.
But you know, Kate Winslet is someone who takes, you know, she's working, but she's not making big movies. She's making Little Children. She's making Sunshine, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless yeah. Mind. She's making the Peter Pan.
Jack Nicholson made $60 million off the first Batman movie, which in today's dollars would be like $120 million, because he got the greatest deal in the history of deals, which they later yeah. realized how stupid that was. But so you got to imagine Jack Nicholson, even today, his entire lifestyle, and he makes a lot of great movies and is great in them, The Departed, other stuff. But you got to think that the minute he made Batman, and he probably worked 2 months on that movie, he set himself for life to an extremely comfortable level, and he literally never had to work again.
Well, I don't know. I don't know really where I'm going with this, but it's interesting to think about someone who's good with their money and doesn't need to work for the money, and yep. they can work because they enjoy it, versus someone who
yeah.
gets into the lifestyle and suddenly all their money is going towards supporting this ridiculous lifestyle that's disposable,
yep.
gigantically expensive houses, drugs, you know, fast cars, whatever, and suddenly they find they have to keep making movies and to support the lifestyle instead of...
Well, there's a couple actors out there that are... It's interesting if you look at specifically... what's his name from the Gangs of New York?
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, Daniel Day-Lewis. Daniel Day-Lewis and to some extent Edward Norton, it's pretty clear... They never take roles that are not completely and totally interesting in them, and they might wait years between them. And I have such a fundamental respect for that. Even if I don't like the movies, I'm never going to see them make, even though I love George Clooney, they are never going to make an Ocean's 13, ever. You're not going to see Daniel Day-Lewis in Ocean's 13. And the one challenge with Ed Norton is he got stuck making that Italian job, which he hated and did, but it was a totally different kind of deal.
Well, and it's, you know, and I respect anyone in the Ocean's movies or someone who says, you know what, I respect someone that says, you know what, this is a payday film.
Yeah, I do too, but I also even more respect people that go, I'll never do a payday film.
Yeah, oh, completely.
So even though I totally have no problem with George Clooney, because he's awesome.
But to me, like, exactly, George Clooney in an Ocean's film is a payday film, but also
it's an enjoyable movie. Yeah,
they're having fun.
Yeah, that's true. If it was a payday movie that you're going, I'm so angry that this movie's even out there, which sometimes you'll see. But yeah, you'll never, I could not imagine George Clooney in a movie that I wouldn't kind of enjoy seeing, even if I look at it as a payday movie. Anyway,
the other film you had was Playtime.
Yeah, Playtime was this. Playtime was a movie filmed in 1967 by a director named Jacques Tati. And it was one of those movies they released on Criterion Collection and then went out of circulation. So like the copies were going for like $300-$400. It's sort of like the Spinal Tap Criterion version.
Oh my God, that reminds me.
That I have, which I could probably sell for like $300 on eBay because it's out of circulation. But anyway, so it was out of circulation. Well, they just re-released. I watch it, and it's this incredible movie. It's like this director in like the late 60s basically built this entire modern city that he filmed within outside of Paris to show. It was kind of like there's no real plot to this movie, but it's kind of like a comic take on a slice of ultra-modern life. And it was just, I don't know, just stunning. So I just watched it. Mark watched it with me. So far, I was paying attention to him. He slept through probably 93% of the movie. And when it was over, he's going, well, that was interesting. That was a weird movie. And I'm going, it was a weird movie. And even for the 7% that he saw was weird. And I was going to tell him.
It's funny how often Mark has slept through things.
I know. The movies.
And we're not making fun of the guy.
No, yeah, he ends up having a pretty good assessment of movies despite missing most of them.
Well, he also slept through.
That's true.
No, the reason he does is because he's got, you know, He's a busy, busy man. Yeah, he is. He's been working on his PhD, and he's a very smart guy.
So I totally forgot he's left through David Cross. We were like in the front row.
I know.
That must have been so embarrassing for David Cross.
No, you pointed out David Cross must not have seen him, because yeah, if he had, he would have
killed him. Yeah, but anyway, it's a cool movie. It's highly, highly recommended. It's a movie that this guy directed. He spent 10 years trying to make it, get financing, filmed it in 70 millimeter. It's one of the few movies filmed in 70 millimeter, and like Lawrence of Arabia and stuff. And of course, it bankrupted him. And you watching it later realize he went bankrupt. The financiers took the rights to all his old movies after this movie. You feel bad because such a great movie that its time was not really recognized.
There was
cool movie.
I saw a commercial yesterday, and in it, the music was a cover of a Spinal Tap song.
Oh, I saw that. Give me some money.
And I started thinking, was Spinal Tap covering that song? Or was that
original? No.
I'm thinking, no, it had to be original because some of the lyrics are so out there.
That was the irony of that. I remember watching
that
going... It was
like a credit card commercial or something.
I was thinking about that.
I think it was American Express.
It was. It's exactly what it was. And the song is Give me some money. That thing. So, you know, what was funny about that was... It was like that movie was kind of in the movie was done as a joke to sound like those early 60 songs.
Yeah.
But so simple, so simply thought through. Give me some money. Well, what's funny is that movie was basically filmed around 1982, and it was describing a song that they had written like 18, 17 years earlier.
Uh-huh.
Well, now it's like 25 years beyond Spinal Tap. So it was much closer to the time then than it is now. And it just, to some extent, they realized, hey, nobody knows this and it's entered some pantheon. It sounds like an early 60s movie. It's so weird that these ad companies take these early...
I wonder who owns the rights to the songs.
Well, the writing is definitely the guys.
Right. No, but it's... You know, because rights, as we've discussed, are very convoluted.
Yep. Well, I guarantee you that the Spinal Tap folks are making money off that ad. And
well, you'd have to
happy.
Think if it was a record company or a label, you know,
yep.
whoever, well, I don't even, Sony or whoever's left of the music labels, if they had the publishing rights, you have to imagine they would have been milking them for all they were worth before now.
Yeah, but I'm just not so sure that there's much you could do. I mean, most of the songs are specific and jokey and have sex jokes
in
them.
I guess that's true.
And then
I don't know, Sex Farm.
Sex Farm. Working on a sex farm. Or Big Bottom.
Big Bottom.
Oh, my God.
Talk about mud flaps. But I just... My baby's got them.
So watching that ad for the first time, I go, oh, my God. And I'm sure everybody else that's into Spinal Tap had that immediate reaction. The irony is I don't think they, when they put that ad together, were looking for us ironists that liked the Spinal Tap. I think they thought this is kind of a generic song that sort of suits our purpose. I'm not so sure, because there was nothing in there that was nudge, nudge, wink, wink to say, hey, Spinal Tappies,
right.
It's a song for you.
But on the other hand, it's so blatant. Give me some money.
Yeah, I know.
To use with a credit card ad. That's bizarre. Yeah,
it's not subtle at all. But then again, you know, I mean, look at what is it, Caribbean Crew or Celebrity that uses Lust for Life, you know, an ode to heroin.
God, and that drives me bonkers every time I see that commercial. Yeah. Every single time. My wife is like, well, is it a song about good heroin or bad heroin?
That's true.
And I was like, I had to think
she
about
brings
it for
up a
second.
Good point.
I was like, well, I think it's sort of the entire heroin experience from what I understand.
That's right.
Oh God, and there was a Slate thing about some of the worst commercials of the year. I'm trying to remember. One thing I really like about Slate, probably the only thing that I
like their
about
ad report
cards, is the Seth Stevenson.
Yep, I love that.
And I'm trying to remember now what some of them were, but
Slate drives me nuts. Pretty much every article is here's the meta description of every article. Okay, here's something in popular culture that everybody's celebrating, but we're going to tell you why it sucks and then explain. You know, everything, if anything's popular or anything's going on, they have to have an article that says, this. You know, you need to realize it actually sucks and we're going to tell you why. It doesn't matter if we're talking about a politician, a person, a movie, anything. that's their angle on things. It's just, it's really annoying to a certain extent, because you can just go, oh, wow, everybody loves, although it's not true of Children and Men, but everybody's loving Children and Men. I better read Slate to find out why it sucks, you know? You know, and that's basically their little angle, so... Anyway,
In your spiel there, I couldn't remember any of the ones they talked about, so I guess we should let that drop.
Yep.
Seems like we're coming to the end.
Hour and 15 minutes. Time for you to head off and watch a Seahawk game.
Yep. You guys rock at mustardayonnaise.com. Oh, don't change channels for the Hawk game now. I'm
just going to click and...
I'm about to get up and go out the door.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
You guys rock at mustardayonnaise.com is how you contact us. If there's something you would like us to discuss, address, a question you would like us to answer, we will do so.
Absolutely.
Is your question, why does Richard have almost 1,000 DVDs?
We will address that. I think I might actually be over. I just have been so derelict in putting them. I'm pretty sure I'm pretty close. I just keep forgetting to put them into my system.
You've been saying you're about 20 or 30 away, but it doesn't seem like you've gotten.
But I keep buying them. In the last 2 weeks, I've purchased like 6.
Maybe you are, maybe you aren't. You need to do your thing, and then we'll do our special thing. Okay. Maybe your question is about the Big Lebowski.
That's true.
We will entertain any questions you have about the Big Lebowski.
Absolutely.
All right. So let's. Yeah. I. Blah 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 blah. We're done.
Avio. Au revoir. A bientôt. Auf Wiedersehen.